Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Sataglia. She's been called a Catholic visionary and a renegade nun. Sister Joan Chittister is one of the leading spiritual voices of our day. A member of the Benedictine Sisters of Erie, she is a sought-after speaker and best-selling author with more than 40 books to her name. We'll talk with her about her faith journey, about the role of women in society and the church, and about the stunning new biography about her life and influence.
Sister Joan Chittister, welcome back to Penn State and to our studios. It's a delight to see you again.
Thanks, Patty. I love this place. I come at the drop of any excuse. So,
Well, actually, you're here for a very big reason. In fact, Penn State has partnered with Mercyhurst University in Erie and the Erie Benedictine community to preserve your literary archives.
Yes.
So why those two universities and who gets what?
Well, we all get everything thanks to Penn State. These two universities, of course, Mercyhurst was my bachelor's degree and just a marvelous teaching university. I mean, I've said to those people, I've been around the world 5, 6, 7 times now, and I have never had to apologize for that early education. And on the basis of that education, Penn State was just a natural for me.
For your PhD.
Opportunity, yes, for the PhD, because it was the same quality of learning. I had been accustomed to research and to heavy thinking and being able to produce. So it was the perfect marriage. And when it came time to determine where all of this material was going to go, it was very difficult. And out of the blue, to be quite frank, small colleges simply could not have handled my papers. There were already too much, something like 90 linear feet or something of that nature, of papers that had already
papers that are aside from your 50-plus books.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely aside. All of them speeches or research projects or something of that nature. And Penn State said, when they were interested in the papers, I said, Why would you care about the papers of a nun? I mean, you have to realize that a lot of this is going to come out of a theological perspective and a lot of it out of questions of the role of church and society and all those things. And that doesn't seem to me that you would care about that. Well, I mean, I just got phenomenal information about the way Penn State handles its archives and libraries and incorporates it into every department. They said, our history department will know. We have a department of religion, the women's department. You're a speecher from Penn State, for heaven's sakes.
A speecher.
It was the perfect marriage. And then they said this, however, we understand that you have a very close relationship with Mercyhurst. Tell you what. Your community is very concerned about losing your papers, and rightly so, but we do not have the physical background to keep them. And so it was Penn State that said, look, let's try something new. What if Penn State becomes the site of all of your papers and journals and all that material? But we will service both your community and
the Benedictine college, community
and
Mercyhurst
College.
By digitizing, I'm imagining,
absolutely.
All of this material.
So, as a result, the Benedictine Sisters have access to everything, and we have an archive room. People can come in there and study. Mercyhurst opened its own room and has access to all of the audio material, all the written material. So any of their teachers can say, we want you to go see this video and answer these questions. It couldn't be better, Patty.
You know, you asked just a moment ago, why would Penn State be interested
yes.
in the work of a nun? And the truth of the matter is, it was becoming a nun that allowed you
yes.
first to go to Mercyhurst
yes.
and then on
and then to Penn State.
For your PhD in
That's
speech
right.
communication.
That's right.
So you were 16 years old.
Yeah.
Actually, you were 15 years old when you knocked on the door of the prioress and said, I want to be
I
a
want
nun.
To come.
She
no.
turned you away.
Yes.
Said
come
you
back
come
next
back
year,
next
dear.
Year.
Yes.
What
come.
Happened when you came back the next
well,
year?
I did. On April 26th, the next year, I did exactly the same thing. Walked to the same doorway, pressed the same bell, and waited for her door to open. And she came out. She was looking around, looking for somebody who was looking for her. And then I said to her, Mother, I rang your bell. And she looked at me for a minute, and I could tell she didn't really remember. And I said, Mother, I came last year, and I told you I wanted to be a Benedictine. She said, yes, dear, yes. I said, well, I was 15. You told me that I couldn't enter until I'm 16. Well, I'm 16 today. And she looked at me like this. She said, so? I said, so? I'm 16 now, so I'd like to enter. And she suddenly, you could see everything go together in her head. And she said, my dear child, she said, no, you can't enter. And I said, why not? And she said, well, dear, you're an only child, and we don't take only children. Why not? I'd never had anybody give me that reason for not being able to do anything in life. And she said, because, dear, someday your mother is going to need you. And you see, if you enter the convent, you won't be able to help her as much as she should be helped. So no, we don't take only children. So I left, Fanny, and I went straight home. Well, out that back door, up Parade Street as fast as I could get, over to Holland, and I got in the door and I said, Mom, something terrible happened. And she said, what's that? I said, I went to see Mother Sylvester about entering today because I'm 16 and you can enter when you're 16. My mother said, really? And I said, but I'm not allowed. And she said, why not? And I said, because I'm an only child. My mother sat up like this, little strong little woman. And she said, because you're an only child? Yes, they say you're going to need me. She said, call Mother Sylvester's office and get an appointment. And 2 hours later, we appeared at that same convent in that same parlor. And my mother made it very, Mother Sylvester was very kind. Oh, no, Mrs. Chittister, she said, we wouldn't do that. We know Joan is an only child. And my mother said, yes, she is. And that is not her fault. And I do not want her life lived paying for my life. She can do anything she wants to do. Now, Mother, I'm going to tell you something. You may not want Joan in this community, and that's fine. But I know this kid better than you do. And she's made up her mind to be a nun, and she will be one, either here or somewhere else. And Mother Sylvester said, do you mean that? And she said, I do mean it. That's why I'm here. And she said, well, then we better begin to talk about an entrance.
And, you know, it should be added that your mother wanted to be a nun and, in fact, had sewn her own habit.
That's right.
She was the youngest of 13 children.
Yes.
She hid it under her bed, and when her mother found it, she burned it.
Yes, because she was the youngest of 13. Grandpa was very sick at that time. She said, I can't do this alone. I can't do this without you. I can't let you go to a convent. Now, here's the irony. She was going to go to Mercyhurst. She intended to be a Mercy nun in Erie because the Mercies already taught in Dubois. So she had had the Mercies in grade school. So she was coming to Erie to be a Sister of Mercy. And Grandma just couldn't do it. And so the years went by, and she and my dad had dated since high school. And when he finished high school, that was it. She never dated anybody else.
You mentioned your father, and you're talking about your biological father.
Yes, that's right.
In Tom Roberts' hot off the press, absolutely stunning biography of your life, Joan Chittister, Her Journey from Certainty to Faith, he tells us a story about Joan Chittister that even your closest friends didn't know. Your biological father died when you were just 3 years old.
And my mother married
and
again.
Your mother,
and it was an interesting dynamic to us in an academic fashion now, Patty. But then it wasn't interesting. It was cataclysmic. My mother was Irish Roman Catholic, and my stepfather was Presbyterian. One thing I can attest to, Catholics did not have a monopoly on prejudice. Every Christian denomination had been taught that everybody else was wrong. And the anti-Catholicism was particularly deep. There was fear, not unfounded, about papal control of the Catholic mind and Catholic institutions and everything that went with it. At any rate,
this was a mixed marriage.
This was what you call a mixed marriage.
And it was big.
And it was big at that time. And every church taught that it was wrong. You married your own. And so when these two married, they crossed every possible boundary. And his family and his mother was no happier about it than members of the Catholic community would have been. Now, interestingly enough, her family, the Catholic family, didn't fuss about this at all. If this is what they wanted to do, they were happy. But my stepfather's mother was really, this was a major problem for her. At any rate, the point is that that marriage never really fit on any level. It's very hard for a young couple under any circumstances to maintain a marriage when the families are against it. The old prejudices were entombed in both of them. And so I used to say life was wonderful until they began to fight the wars of religion all over again. And once we got to the religious level, I knew there was no saving it. It was going to be catastrophic. And so that marriage was fraught. And he drank, and drank heavily. And every time he drank, these are the issues that came up. So it was a very volatile environment.
In fact, there's a story in that book where your mother talks your stepfather into going to the church to see about converting. And when he reads that the Catholic Church is the one true church, mm-hmm. and this implies that his mother is not going to go to heaven, he said, I'm out of here. Yeah. Loretta, we're leaving. Yeah.
No, he said this, actually. He said to the priest, are you telling me that my mother is not going to go to heaven? And the priest, they had these little booklets or something, pushed the book over in front of him and said, well, read, what does it say? And he turned to Loretta and he said, I'm out of here. Are you coming with me or staying with him? She got up and they both walked out. And after that, it was never a matter of conversation whatsoever. So that priest managed to cement the division that was built right into this marriage socially. And then you add alcohol to that and see what you get. It's a witch's brew. And they were both good people. I know they both loved me. I never doubted that I was loved by either one of them. My father was wonderful to me, but the environment was just...
And there were frequent moves because of violent outbursts mm-hmm. and your family being kicked out of this house or this apartment because of it.
Right.
So
That's
for
right.
you, when you finally went to the convent at age 16, it was the first time in your life that you felt truly, absolutely safe and free.
Safe, free, peaceful. Quiet, ordered, purposeful, stable, and you could trust it. You could count on it. And so it was a very special kind of gift. I didn't consciously know that until I got there and realized I've been in the community for 64 years. I've never heard a voice raised. coming out of exactly the opposite dynamic and everything that it implies for a relationship, for psychological development, for a sense of security, and yet the community offered all of that and a good life and a sense of purpose, and I loved them. I loved the sisters because they were very good with one another. We kids could see that. They were very funny. And they worked, I mean, they were wonderful. It was so easy. I know that there are all those Catholic stories about raging nuns, but I never had one. The sisters and the kids mixed all the time. I knew that life was life-giving. And I was right. I've never regretted it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is Sister Joan Chittister, a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Erie. Her resume of honors and awards includes 12 honorary doctorates, plus the one she earned from Penn State in speech communication.
In fact, in the book, Tom Roberts, he dedicates, on the dedication page, he dedicates it to women religious who are in places all over the world.
Yeah.
Oftentimes the only people representing the Catholic Church.
That's right.
And of course you're one of them. You've literally been to 30 countries over the 60 countries.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them many, many, many times.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about the work that you do in these countries.
Well,
and why.
That work took several forms. At first, I began to be called to speak in communities who were going through what we called renewal after Vatican II. That was a major change. Everybody saw the nuns go through that. One day, they looked like Cupid dolls in the 13th century, and the next day, they looked like real people.
Like
now,
you do
yes,
in street clothing.
They, yes, and the laity, many of them worried a lot. They said, you know, what has happened to these sisters? They've gone absolutely crazy. They've abandoned their schools, and they've abandoned their... Well, as a matter of fact, we did what we did in order to be able to move freely with people who needed us in a whole different kind of society now. Remember that we had been working in the ghettos for a couple hundred years, but we were working in Catholic ghettos. As the Catholics were flowing in, you know, from Ireland and Germany and Spain, and then suddenly from Eastern Europe, and you had all those ethnic schools growing up, we were working with what we would today call a disadvantaged population. Then we began, after 150 years, we had prepared those people for a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant society where they fit in now very easily and without any kind of rupture. So we looked around, we suddenly had all sorts of other immigrants who weren't necessarily Catholic. Who was going to be with them? So we just decided that the Catholic schools, we had built that system. It was ready to go. If you want to take it. And we began to move in other directions with poor people, not necessarily Catholics at all. We didn't ask, and we don't to this day. We don't ask for your baptismal certificate. We ask if you're hungry. We ask if you need anything. We ask if there's anything we can do. And that is our life. It's always been our life. But my uniform now is whatever clothes people give me, by and large. That's my uniform. And that gets me on the street, and I understand. I know what that little girl feels like when she can't get a dress for a date.
Because you were that kid.
Yeah, I was that kid. So it's the same life, and yet it's a fuller life. It's a different life. It's the same ministry, and it didn't abandon anybody. It's better than it's ever been.
I want to explore that a little bit more, but I want to start with this. You say that what you and I believe in God colors everything we do in the name of God.
That's right.
So that it's the kind of God that we choose. You talk about it, is it the Santa Claus God who fulfills all of our wishes, or the gotcha God who punishes you for all of your failures?
Just waiting for you to slip. Just waiting for you to make a mistake. I created you so you could go to hell. I mean, and the puppeteer God. You know, I want you to do this and this and this. And here's the God of the black box. Here, I have a plan for your life, Patty, and it's in this black box, and the box is locked, and you can't get at it. But if you don't complete that plan, you're not going to make it. I mean, that's human beings projecting onto God their own defects and disabilities and smallnesses. Someplace along the line, some wag wrote on a wall someplace, first God created us, then we created God.
Oh, great. Give us then your definition of God.
Well, the question is, who is God in an evolutionary world? I mean, science has told us now how life comes about and how life is, in essence, a kind of self-creating. We see that in the fossils. Even the fossils show us something about God. We had the idea that God zapped everything into existence uniquely, with a special purpose. Well, if that's the case, then why did God make 40 kinds of toad? You'd think that God would have been better decision maker than 39 inefficient samples of it. So here you have the God of evolution, and that God for me is the God who seeds the universe with life and then allows that life to work its own way out and up and makes that life responsible for all other life. The God of evolution is the God of becoming, who is a humble God, sharing the power of life, sharing creation with the two of us. Now suddenly free will is really significant. Everything that you and I do, do we have recycling barrels in our houses now? If not, we are also responsible for the destruction of the earth. Suddenly free will means everything. And the presence of God, who is life, is with me to hold me up, to call me on through these difficult moments in my life and the life of this whole society, so that together we can complete the creation that God began. God and I are partners now. God and I are co-creators. God and I are participants in this common task of being fully human and really taking care of this whole earth and everybody that's in it. This is a great God. This is not a small and puny God.
And this is something you've come to learn over years and years of questioning, and you say that doubt is not the enemy of faith. In fact, that's what brought you to where you are right now.
Yes.
And that brings me to Pope Francis's recent visit to the United States, which I think changed a lot of people's opinions about the Catholic Church. You said it was the smiling face of the church, and he came when we needed him. But one of the things you said in an open letter to him is that unless you address the issues of women, the poorest of the poor, then in a sense, your talk about helping the poor is empty.
Yeah, you can't do anything about poverty unless you do something about women. And you cannot convince me that you really care about the poor and poverty unless you do something for women. Why? Because women are the poorest of the poor. When you sit here in affluent America, and you have college-educated women who are getting 25% less for the work they do than the men who are doing the same job, despite the fact that this widowed mother or single mother in a situation like my own mother had been in has to pay the same amount of money for a gallon of gas and a loaf of bread and a bit of milk and a doctor for that baby as any man does.
And a man told her she couldn't go to work.
That's right. There'll be one paycheck in this house and it's mine, or otherwise I'm quitting. And your mother, and even you to a certain extent, you lived in that era, you know, when somehow or other it was an attack on a male's fragile IQ and image and ego if a woman wasn't dependent on him. And yet what we need are partnership marriages, you know, not him and this domestic servant, not him and this dependent little inferior creature. And so unless we're both coming to fullness, unless our legislation reflects equality, reflects justice, reflects opportunity for all of us, then don't tell me that as a country we care about women. We don't.
Well, let's talk about this, because you have said that the world is operating or seeing with one eye, with one ear, and with half a mind, and the decisions that we've made
show it.
And you are pushing for more inclusion of women in the church, not just in the church, but in society.
Everywhere.
And there is serious pushback.
The scandal is that secular society is doing more for women than the churches have ever done. Ordination is not the only indicator whatsoever of equality.
Right.
It's a thing out there. It's a symbol of it now. It's become a symbol.
To you, it's the possibility of ordination, not the actual ordination of women.
It's the question of ordination. Follow the questions. What are the reasons that this is, quote, not possible? It's possible any minute we make it possible. This is nonsense to say it's not possible. Those are the kinds of questions, you see, that get us to the foundations of the faith. And they get us to ask, does this make sense in the light of the scripture? is this the way Jesus treated women? Were women excluded? And when you come back with all of those disciples and women starting the churches, the house churches in the early church. So ordination is an historical issue that has something to do with the question of what is equality, where do you see it, what does it look like? And if anybody required me to show up at the cathedral tomorrow to be ordained, I would not go.
It's not your interest.
I don't have a call to the priesthood. I'm not a priest, but I believe I know women who are.
You talk about two kinds of religious people, the professionally religious and the golden rule religious. What makes one kind and the other the other kind?
What I'm trying to say in those two different situations is this. The professional religious is a person who's been trained in a faith, some faith, Hinduism, Buddhism, Sufism, Islam, Israel, Catholicism. We have all the training. We have the theological answers. We have the catechisms and the rule books and the checklists, and that's great. And those are all disciplines meant to hone us to an awareness of the divine in life. Great. But there are all manner, two-thirds of the world who's never had any kind of training like that. And what they're working off of is the whole question of their place in humanity. And the golden rule, you see, is that basic, do unto others, do not do unto others what you do not want done to yourself. Do what you would think would be good for you. And when we come to that, we come to the heart of God. When God says, I wish you well and not woe, I will not do to you what I would not want done, the happiness factor in life. I will do for you. I will make available to you in this universe, go for it, so that you can come to the fullness of yourself. What I'm trying to say is there's a deep down, fundamental, built-in, hardwired sense of goodness, holiness, and completion that's in us as human beings. And you can put all the catechisms on top of it that you want, but at the end of the day, holiness lies right down there with the way you treat the world.
Well, you say that from childhood we're told these are the rules and follow the rules and you will get along in the world. And you say what we really need is a world where people develop the art of questioning, that questions are so vital.
I tell people all the time, follow your questions. Never suppress your questions. Your questions will lead you always and everywhere to God. Do not be afraid that a question is either dissent or doubt or faithlessness or infidelity of any type. Questions are that impulse toward growth and understanding. And when we melt into God at the end of all of this, then you see, we will come to the fullness that we've sought.
We have very little time left, so I want to end with this. You are 78 years old. 79.
Yes. Yes.
And there is no evidence that you are slowing down. So I'm wondering, what is on your bucket list? What is still left for Joan Chittister to do?
Oh, I've never had a bucket list in my life. I love that concept. It amuses me. My bucket list is open my door when somebody rings a doorbell and do what that moment demands. And I've been deeply blessed by going through life like that. I've received a great deal more than I've ever been able to give. I've learned more than I've ever taught, and I've seen holiness that's totally different than what I once believed sanctity was. It's not about the narcissistic and private self-sanctification of the self. It is about this contributing to the ongoing creation of God's creation. That's our holiness.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Patty. Always.
That was Sister Joan Chittister, a Penn State graduate and author of more than 50 books. Her body of written work will be archived at Penn State. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.